So we are a week out from the election, and a whole, you know, everybody in certain corners of the media is offering their hot take on why things happened the way they did, and a lot of Dharma teachers have offered beautiful writings, and thoughts on the matter. And so I got thinking and wondering what was helpful to say. I'm not sure entirely what's helpful to say, but the place that my reflection started to go to ended up at reflecting on the nature of action and karma, or kamma in Pali. So let me tell you a little bit about how I got there, and then I'll tell you some of the reflections that came once I got there. Like a lot of folks on the progressive left, I had some of those same feelings of like, what happened? How did this happen? Why did this happen? You know, that's sort of the emotional response. I'm happy to be transparent about saying that I wanted something different to happen. But I also found myself really dissatisfied with some of the kinds of explanations, but also some of the different kinds of criticism and judgment and blame that happened on the left, following this election loss. And the direction that really got me thinking was and that I found most interesting was around folks who have been, not just in the last week, but for a long time now, focusing on the change in the information economy of the world that's come, you know, through social media, but particularly has come through the vast kind of democratization of information, where a few media companies are no longer holding the, you know, governing the doors to knowledge. And, you know, anyone who has anything to say can, you know, put their blog up or, you know, post something somewhere, all these sort of things. And that one of the results of this, right, is that disinformation, misinformation, outright lies, but also just a million different points of view are all swirling out there. So this is one thing that the education landscape is broader and wilder and less controlled than it used to be. Another piece is that since the Citizens United decision, but it was happening for a while before that, the mix of this information ecosystem with the realities of advertising and the consumer economy is really, you know, the result of Citizens United was that money equals speech, and I got thinking about how powerful advertising is, how powerful propaganda is, how powerful misinformation is, how powerful lies are, and that there's a fundamental assumption in both consumer capitalism and democracy, modern democracy. And that assumption is that people make their own choices, right? That you, confronted with, you know, an enormous selection of you know, breakfast items in the aisle at the grocery store, that you are a kind of intelligent, self-preservation-oriented, rational consumer who assesses the options and somehow decides intelligently what to buy, right? This is the heart of the consumer economy. And the assumption in there is that consumers are intelligent. And I don't mean like fundamentally like, you know, like basic intelligent humans, but I mean that like well-informed, able to read labels, able to assess competing claims. You know, if five different cereals all say we are super healthy, the consumer is expected to be able to assess that marketing for its truthiness, to use an old term from the George W. Bush era. But we know from marketing, right, that it takes a lot of regulations to keep marketing truthful, right? There's a lot of regulations about what you can say, you know, when you can call something organic or when you can call something natural. And there's rules about all these things because if marketing wants to sell you things, one of the best things it can do is lie to you, right? It can say, our product is super awesome. It will make you, you know, healthy and sexy and smart and rich. Of course you will buy this, right? If we can convince you that our product is so good, we'll buy it. And so, you know, you're not supposed to be able to lie. That's one piece. But also, you know, you can tell what happens when, you know, when a company gets some enormous market share and there's not very many other options. Like, you know, you all have computers that essentially either run the Apple operating system or the Windows operating system, unless you're some kind of like radical Linux freak, and blessings to you. But otherwise, you know, there's only two things to choose from. So you bought one of them. And so there's that, there's monopolies. But in addition, there's just the power of advertising. That if you get told that something is like the best thing, the coolest thing, the beautifulest thing, the most wonderful thing, over and over and over and over by a gazillion different people, and they write articles about it, and half your friends have the thing and all that, it's very likely that you will believe that marketing, right? It just works that way. We are information creatures, and marketing is just another form of education, you know? And education in a certain way works the same way. If you're told a certain set of values again and again, you know, whether that's like Christian values or postmodern Marxist academic values or, you know, whatever, patriotic values, you know, if you're told them again and again and again by a lot of different sources, you start to live within that knowledge ecosystem, right? Even if it's wrong, you know? And it could be wrong because the true thing hasn't been discovered yet. Like, you could be a flat earther in the year 800 because you're pre-Copernicus, and it's not your fault. It doesn't happen to be right, but it's not your fault, you know? And so, and you can be subject to propaganda that is very powerful and pervasive and very hard to think outside the box of. And so I want to suggest that politics and voting is very, very similar to the consumer economy and shopping, that we are subject to very strong marketing. The marketing is being controlled by people with a lot of money. It's very hard to have to dissent from very strong marketing and propaganda. And so the question that I want to raise then is I want to question the assumption at the heart of both the consumer economy and the political economy, which is that individuals are able to make independent choices. Like, I think we're all technically able to do so, given, but there's a lot of givens, you know, given correct information, given good data, given unbiased, trustable sources of news, you know, given the time and privilege to even focus on it in between, you know, picking the kids up from school and tending somebody's sickness and taking care of all the things you have to take care of and whatever you got to do, to actually sit down and, you know, there was a time, there was an election recently, it was in California. It might have been 2 years ago, it might have been four. It was sometime in the recent, it wasn't this time, but it was one recent one, where there were two ballot measures that we had to vote on. They did exactly opposite things, but they were worded almost exactly the same. Does anyone remember that? And they were like, they were two measures about the same topic that were slightly different. And you had to do all this research, and then you had to figure out that the best thing to do, if you were, let's say, a progressive who wanted a certain result, was to vote yes on one, the correct one of them, and no on the correct other one. And I could barely keep it straight. And I was like, dude, I have like a PhD and I tried to understand it. And I think I got it right, but it was very difficult. And I was like, this is impossible. You know, a ballot measure is supposed to be this great democratic thing. So you can propose a ballot measure in California. Anyone can. I told my kid River, who's eight, I said, it's like, anybody can propose a ballot measure. And he said, I could propose a ballot measure? And I was like, yeah, what do you want to become a law? And he came up with some marvelous ideas. You know, everyone should get ice cream every day. And I'm like, yeah, okay. So first you need 100,000 signatures of people who think that that's a good idea. And then, you know, they check those, you know, I told him about the whole process. And I said, and then we could vote on it. And you know, but the result of that, right, in reality, is that, you know, a few very rich corporations and lobbying groups put things on the ballot in very confusing language and then market the shit out of it, and they get their result a lot of the time. Not always, right, but a lot of the time. So in, you know, it's a core Buddhist idea to challenge the idea that we are independent, separate beings, right? The teaching on not self or non-self says that it seems like we are unique, separate individuals. And in some senses, we certainly are. But if we really drill down into what that thing is that we feel when we feel like a me, like a myself, that thing that we feel is tethered to or built up by or given birth to from all these other conditions. And so, like, if I take the sense that I have of being an independent thinker, I'm like, oh, I'm, you know, I've got education and privilege and, you know, political awareness and all these things. I think for myself, I assess issues, and I do try to do all of that. I think I do it as well as many. But if I look at all of that, what do I find? You know, I find at the heart of that, among many things, I find a set of values, for instance, right? Where do those values come from? Right? Some of them came from, you know, the family that I was raised in, which was a kind of liberal Catholic family in California. So it had some sort of socially progressive values and some not socially progressive values. It also came, but then I went to art school and I was around like super radical, like performance art types. And then I went into the humanities and I was around like, you know, academic kind of deconstruction, French post-structuralist Marxist kind of people. Some of that comes through still. But like all of those ideas, you know, let's say an idea that, you know, that borders are, you know, a kind of violent colonial imposition on the, you know, ecosystem of peoples, right? That's a very fringe leftist idea. I didn't come up with that idea in a vacuum. I didn't just like look around the world and be like, what's up with borders? Why are there borders? There's weird fictions, you know? Why can't I just, at one point I walked across the border from the US to Canada. I was hitchhiking across the country and somebody dropped me off on the United States side of the border between northern Minnesota and Canada. So I just walked to the border and I was gonna go across and the border guy was like, you can't walk across the border. I'm like, why? You know? And I almost wanted to be like, I wasn't yet the kind of, you know, academic punk that would be like, borders are a post-colonial fiction, you know? But they are. We just agree to them, you know, mostly unwillingly or unconsciously. But like, that idea is not mine. I don't own that idea. It came from somewhere, right? And, you know, my idea that all people have inherent worth, that came from somewhere, you know? And the negative ones do too, right? The ways that I inherited assumptions about what being male means or what being female means or what being, you know, light-skinned means or what being dark-skinned means or what being rich means or what being poor means. I inherited those from a patriarchal, misogynistic, racist, classist culture, right, that I grew up in. And I inherited some privilege and some trauma. And when we look at the what is myself that is making a choice at all, what we find is all these layers of things that were learned. And that means they were taught to us, which means that they were funded. And somebody wanted to, you know, project that idea into the world. And so when I'm shopping for something, I know, if I'm being wise, that, you know, I'm not like a unique sovereign shopper out in the ecosystem of the universe with access to anything. Like, wealth makes you think that you are that, but you're not actually, right? You have access to a relatively small number of things. And depending on where you are, you know, your choices are quite limited, quite constrained by what's on offer and what's being marketed to you. And what you're even, this is really a piece from academic deconstruction, but even what you are able to think is constrained by the language and the concepts that you've been taught, right? If you don't speak the Inuit language that has 20 words for snow, you can't describe the differences between these different kinds of snow. It's just snow. And they're like, no, this is like slightly melted sleet bordering on half fluffy droplets that you know, whatever. And that has a word, you know, and they're like, oh, no. And you're like, oh, yeah, that thing. You're like, no, it's not that anymore. Now it's just turned into sleet. And you're like, oh, I have a word for that. And you're like, no, it's not quite that. It's something else. You know, if you become fluent or an expert in any discourse, you have a lot more vocabulary for it than someone who's not fluent in that thing. And so you can only think in the language that you've been taught to think in, and in the ecosystem of concepts that you've been taught to think in. So I got to this because I was thinking about, because I was reading a lot of this, like, you know, mainstream centrist and sort of center left commentary that in a pretty unsatisfying way was floating around ideas like, you know, like why did all of these, you know, Black people, Hispanic people, women, you know, vote for this person who wants to deport Hispanic people and constrain women's rights to their own bodies and do all these things? You know, how could so many people vote for this person that seems manifestly evil? And that's a really unsatisfying, you know, line of investigation for me. Partly because it assumes that everybody, including ourselves, are what was traditionally called a rational actors. Rational choice theory appears at the exact same time as America is founded. The Economist Adam Smith writes about it in his book on the Wealth of Nations in 1776. It's called RCT, Rational Choice Theory, also called Rational Actor Theory. And the idea is that in an economy, if people act in accordance with their own self-interest, but in an intelligent way, everything will work out because, you know, the things they need will be uplifted, and the things they don't need, they will reject, and, you know, it'll turn out well for everybody. And that sounds good in theory, and it falls apart very quickly in reality. And one of the ways that it falls apart is that propaganda and marketing convince people to buy things that they don't want or need, and for reasons that are untrue. And so it's very difficult actually to be a rational actor in a propaganda ecosystem or in a marketing ecosystem, because you have to be able to think for yourself. And we all think that we do, but our thinking is constrained by how we are taught to think and the messages that we're given and the choices that we are allowed to make. And so I want to recognize that in this recent election, and that this has been widely reflected on and documented, the degree to which the social media ecosystem and the media ecosystem has made it possible for politicians and power forces to lie more extensively and more deeply than before, and for disinformation and conspiracy to have much more traction than they did in an earlier media environment, it actually makes it possible for a lot of people to receive messages about reality that are very far from material reality. Again, to flash back to the George W. Bush era, it was then, this is 20 years ago now, where in the arguments about whether there were weapons of mass destruction for the first Iraq war, which there weren't, but it was a lie that got us into that war, that someone, a strategist on the Republican side, said, it's all right, because the people that are voting for us no longer live in a truth-based, in a reality-based environment, something like that, right? It's like, oh, well, we're no longer operating in a reality-based environment. Like, that's literally the admission that cohering to communally accepted facts was no longer the primary objective in certain sectors of the information economy. And so how do we operate in a world where truth is not agreed upon, you know, where one group of people can go out saying the data is very clear that the economy is doing great, and then a whole bunch of people can say, but I've heard that the economy is doing terribly. And different ones of us are going to vote depending on which story we've heard. I've heard, oh, the economy is doing great, so I'm going to vote for the people that, you know, and the other people will say, oh, I've heard that the economy is doing terribly. All of this, I think I want to use to point to a certain kind of equanimity, which is the equanimity of not blaming anybody for how they voted. If you think that your vote reflects correctness in a kind of absolute way, to watch out, right? To watch out for superiority, to watch out for thinking that you're just right. But also, if you feel like other people's vote was, you know, terrible or wrong, or like, how could they possibly vote that way? And folks on both sides think that about the other side, by the way, right? To understand that the information that we're each using to vote by is very is more suspect now than ever before. And I don't want to make a false equivalence here. I think it's been clearly demonstrated that the far right, the fascist right in this country, has used disinformation and misinformation and lies in politics in a far more extensive way in this election. So maybe I'm trying to be really balanced here in a semi-nonpartisan way, but I'm going to shift into being a bit partisan here and speak to the leftists and the Democrats in the room. Watch out for demonizing Republican voters because of how they voted, because you may be able to understand how pervasive the conditions are that create votes, to actually understand the political economy where propaganda creates votes, and to not blame anyone for voting based on something that they heard from sources they trust was true. If you get fed lies every day for many, 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 many years, you may find yourself not living in a reality-based ecosystem. And it's a profound violence to take people's connection to reality away. And so I think it's possible to find a deep compassion for everyone struggling to think clearly in a in a propaganda-based ecosystem. And so yeah, to not fall into shaming, and hatred. That even the standard call on the left to try to understand, the people who voted for this, for the opposition here, I think doesn't quite get at it. I think that individual people actually are very understandable. Everyone wants to be well and for their families to be safe. And I think people are voting generally in favor of well-being. If huge numbers of people are making a choice that seems to be bringing about the results that are exactly the opposite of what they want, it's because they were told over and over that this, that reality was different, and the shame and blame, they go both ways, but particularly on the left is a very shamey kind of coalition. Because the American left is a moral coalition, and so it's it falls very easily into attacking other members of its own coalition for impurity. So watch out for that. Remember that this is true not just across the Democratic-Republican divide, but it's true across any ideological divide. So between, more radical leftists and more centrist leftists, the same thing is true. The stories that you constantly hear and imbibe and are, transmitted through the various media that you consume, they create you. They create your vote. And where this is pointing is in a very subtle way. It's pointing toward the sense that we have less agency than we think. I think that we have less, individual, free will than we think. We do have agency and we do have free will, but our agency and free will is conditioned. It's not absolute. It's conditioned by the information we receive, the conditions we bear, the social location we inhabit. You can only think what you've been taught to think. to a very deep extent. And so I think the teaching on kamma or karma recognizes this. It recognizes this, that we have agency to the extent that we can take the reins of our own attention. And I think this is why the heart of the Dharma is an attention training. It's actually learning where to place your attention and how to protect your attention from hostile takeover. In a way, mindfulness and concentration are protections against propaganda and marketing, because the fundamental mechanism of propaganda and marketing is to turn your attention toward someone else's, where someone else wants it to go, rather than where you are choosing for it to go, right? You take back agency from marketing when you refuse to let it guide your choices. And you take back agency from political propaganda when you refuse to let it guide your choices. But to do that takes a lot of slowing down and educating. And, you know, there's that word in the description of the Dhamma, ehipasiko or ehipasika. The Dhamma is to be seen by the wise for themselves. You have to see it for yourself. And so that means you have to get as much information as you can and educate it as much as you can. That doesn't just mean formal education. Anyone can do it. But it takes time and determination and discipline. And it's difficult to wrench your agency back from the forces that would simply own your choices for their own profit and power. But I think that is what the Dhamma asks us to do in service of wisdom, and I think it's what is healthiest to do in a very difficult information ecosystem at the moment. All right, so I hope that makes sense and is helpful. Thank you for listening and taking it in as a piece of information that can guide your actions and your thoughts from here. So we'll have a few moments for questions and reflections from here.